Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Michael Frank. He is David and Lucille Packard Professor of Human Biology and Director of the Symbolic Systems Program at Stanford University. He studies children's language learning and how it interacts with their developing understanding of the social world. And today we're talking about topics like infant-directed speech, pragmatic ability, similarity reasoning, some other aspects of language learning, parenting attitudes, and related topics. So, Dr. Frank, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you. So let's get into the questions then. What is infant-directed speech, and in what ways does it differ from speech directed at adults?
So when we talk to babies, we talk in a very specific way. Our voices get kind of high and squeaky. We tend to simplify what we say. And this is based on the age of the baby we're talking to. But if you're talking to a very young baby, you might hold them in your arms and say, "Oh, aren't you a nice baby?" That would be profoundly weird to do if you were talking to an adult. Yeah. So all of that simplification, stretching out, making more melodic, all of that makes the speech exciting and interesting to infants and seems to draw their attention.
And is infant-directed speech the same across all cultures, or does it vary, for example, in form or in prevalence? How does it work exactly?
I think Americans are maybe among the most fond of really changing their speech to infants. So American infant-directed speech is the most exaggerated in its characteristics. And there are other cultures in Northern Europe that use much less infant-directed speech. So it was initially thought that infant-directed speech was completely universal. I think it's turned out to be quite variable. Nobody talks to infants exactly the same way they talk to adults, I would say, but the degree of exaggeration and change and the nature of that change can vary across cultures.
And do we have any idea why there is that variability? Where exactly does it stem from?
We're not sure where that variability comes from, but it likely intersects with cultural views on childhood and parenthood and the ways that we think it's appropriate to interact with kids. So in some cultures, infants are really a key focal point for discussion and conversation. We really focus in on them. That's not just in the US and the developed world. There are some low and middle income contexts, or even some traditional societies where kids are really focal point. And there are other contexts where children are not expected to be talked to or heard from until they become verbal themselves. So there's quite wide variability in our attitudes towards childhood, and that probably drives the ways we culturally think about expressing ourselves, the kind of register or mode of speech that we use.
And does infant-directed speech help children or infants, in this case, learn a language easier? Because that's a common idea out there, but is it true?
Yeah, I think there are two ways that people have thought about infant-directed speech helping. The first way, I think, is almost certainly true, which is that infant-directed speech draws infants' attention. So the study that I was involved in that looked at this is called Many Babies One. It was a giant collaborative project across many different labs, across many different countries. And what we did was we looked at babies' preference for infant-directed speech. Mm-hmm. And we found that across cultures, even when babies were hearing speech in a language that they didn't know, they still liked the infant-directed version better. So we found quite good evidence for widespread cross-cultural consistency of infant-directed speech preference. Babies like to hear baby talk. Now, the second way that infant-directed speech could help is a little bit more controversial. It might be that some aspects of the structure are uniquely suited for learning. So it might be that the ways we simplify really help babies learn. And I think there's some evidence for that and some evidence against. So we make these exaggerated sounds like, "Hi, baby." Maybe we make the vowels a little bit more distinct from one another. Some cultures, yeah, maybe yes, maybe no. The evidence is a little weaker for that. We do also simplify the sentence structure, and we talk about things that are kind of in the here and now and much more likely to be relevant to the baby. And that aspect of infant-directed speech probably does help early language learning. Using kind of concrete, restricted vocabulary makes it a lot easier to figure out what words mean, especially when babies are starting to be in that age where they're starting to understand how language is connecting to the world around them. So not the super tiny newborns, but maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 month olds, especially going into the first year when they're starting to begin to produce words around their first birthday.
And then in regards to some topics related to language learning, where are pragmatic abilities?
So when linguists talk about the structure of language, they generally distinguish the sound levels. That's a lot of what we were talking about when we were talking about infant-directed speech, from the lexicon and the morphology, the ways that words are combined together in syntax, the semantics, the meaning. And then we talk about pragmatics, which is the communicative aspects of language, the ways that we reason about what somebody is trying to tell us in a particular context. So syntax, semantics, morphology are often thought to be kind of more context independent, but the ways we modulate language, depending on the context, depending on the speaker, depending on the prior discourse, all of that is what we refer to as pragmatics.
Mm-hmm. And what is similarity reasoning?
Similarity reasoning, broadly speaking, we're talking about now cognition rather than language here. We're talking about the ways that we reason about the structure of concepts and how different concepts relate to one another. Studying the structure of concepts, the structure of knowledge, have often used the idea of similarity as a way in to studying the relationships between different concepts.
And do we know if it also varies cross-culturally?
Yeah, absolutely. So the ways that people conceptualize the relationships between concepts is something that varies quite a fair amount. Just as one example of a widely studied cross-cultural difference, there are differences between what's called taxonomic similarity, in the type of concept versus thematic similarity, similarity in the sort of situations that concept occurs in. So that sounds very abstract. A concrete example of this is if I ask you which is more similar, dog versus cat or dog versus bone. Dog versus cat is that taxonomic level of similarity, whereas dog versus bone is thematic. Dog and bone go together in situations, even though they're dissimilar in the kind of concept they are. One is animate, one is inanimate, and so forth. And there's some evidence that in different cultures, you get different levels of emphasis on taxonomic structures versus thematic structures. What are sometimes referred to as weird cultures, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic cultures, tend to have more of a focus on taxonomic structures. Whereas less weird contexts, which is, of course, many different, it's not a category itself, it's a non-category, but many other cultures show more interest in thematic reasoning. And this is something that's been pretty well studied between the West and East Asia, and also more traditional societies versus more industrialized societies.
And do we have a good understanding of where that variability comes from?
I would say not completely. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty deep and interesting question, like how the structure of our concepts reflects our broader theories of the world. Mm-hmm. My lab has done a little bit of work on this. We're not specialists in it, but one thing we're interested in is that reciprocal relationship between language and cognition that you mentioned a little bit in your intro. So we've been interested in whether the structure of kind of linguistic input to kids and to adults reflects those taxonomic and thematic relationships. And we did find some initial evidence for it in a paper last year. So when you look at Chinese language corpora, they seem to show more kind of semantic similarity on the thematic level, whereas English language corpora maybe support taxonomic reasoning a bit more. So that doesn't solve your chicken and egg question, language to conception or conception to language probably both influence each other. But I think there's a suggestion that these different cross-cultural ways of conceptualizing the world really get reflected in language and maybe get perpetuated as well in language.
And does similarity reasoning connect in any way to language or how people use language?
Yeah, I mean, I think similarity and especially sameness, identity, have been really important lenses by which cognitive science has looked at language, cognition, development, and how all of these things compare to one another. So the idea of sameness, especially actually, identity has been a really powerful lens to look at how language enables complex cognition. So there are some, you know, studies using non-human animals and trying to train the concept of exact identity. And you can do this in certain restricted cases, but for more complex tasks using identity, it can be really, really tricky to train even a great ape to do these tasks. Mm-hmm. In contrast, they're actually quite easy for human adults to pick up in just a couple of trials. So there's really kind of a big boundary there, and people have hypothesized that language has something to do with that. So one example, the speculation is that language-trained primates seem to be the only ones who can succeed in these kinds of really complex identity and relational reasoning tasks about sameness. So yeah, these general notions about similarity and identity have really structured our conversation about how language connects to thought and how that relates to children's growing conception when they learn a language and the boundaries between non-human animals and humans.
Mm-hmm. Do children learn some words earlier than others? And if so, why does that happen?
Yeah, so the words that kids learn earliest tend to be things that are grounded in their environment. So they refer mostly to the people around them, the social routines they engage in, like hi, bye, bath time, peekaboo, then the small objects and animals around them, dog, ball, these kinds of things. So the earliest learned words are those that are supported both by the conception of the kids, the ways that they understand the world, and also by the input they get, the language that they are hearing around them.
And is this consistent in any way across languages?
Surprisingly consistent, actually. Of course, the big feature of words is that the words themselves, their forms, vary across languages. But what's surprising, I think, from my perspective, looking at cross-cultural data, is that the actual concepts that kids learn early are really quite related to one another. So one of the big projects that my lab does is called Word Bank. This is a site that offers up a database of children's early words and parents' reports about their language more broadly to people around the world. And we host data from, I think at this point, 30 or 40 languages from around the world. Of course, focused mostly on the developed world and Indo-European languages, but increasingly broadening to some East Asian languages and non-Indo-European languages from other regions. So when you look at these data, you can look and ask, well, what do the first 10 words look like for kids around the world? And it's really, I think, fascinating to see that kids around the world like to talk about these social routines, and the routines aren't that different. I mean, it's greeting people, it's saying goodbye to people, it's the games we like to play with babies. It's the routines that we do with them, as well as the people around them, the kinship terms like mother, mm-hmm. father, grandmother, sister, brother, and then of course like fun small toys and animals. So mm-hmm. I mentioned that this is what we talk to kids about, that's important, and these are things that kids can understand in their environment. One other thing I should say is there's probably also some degree of children's own interest that babies around the world like small animals, like balls and toys, like interacting socially with the people around them. All of that is very important and probably drives their early word learning.
And so before children begin their formal education, when they do it, because of course it's not the case that in all human societies there's formal education, but in the societies where there is formal education, before children begin it, what sources of information do they use to infer the meaning of words?
The biggest one is the social interaction with the people around them. So earliest words are typically learned in what we call grounded social interaction. That is, you know, you can imagine a caregiver and a child playing or talking mm-hmm. about things that are in the here and now around them. And those learning instances are often accompanied by social cues, like parent is sometimes pointing to the object or showing it to the child with their hands. They might be jointly holding it. This creates what researchers have referred to as joint attention, where both the child and the parent know, or the caregiver know, that they're talking about the same thing. They establish a context in which it's mutually known that we're talking about this object. And then when they use a word, that name can be mapped to that object pretty effectively. Now, the prevalence of joint attention across cultures and societies does differ. So the character I'm giving here of this kind of interaction is most frequent in the kind of very child-focused interactions that you see in the US and in Europe. And is a little bit less common in other societies, where learning from overhearing happens more, where the child may be observing an interaction between two peers or between a caregiver and an older child, and observe that same kind of grounded interaction, but now as a third party rather than as the second person.
And so does language learning in children interact in any way with their understanding of the social world? I mean, does one influence the other?
Well, I think of the social understanding and the social motivation of children as a really key driver of language learning. It's kind of the engine that drives that vehicle forward. So the extent to which you care about and want to affiliate with and want to share with other people is really, you know, that's the extent to which you're really engaging with language and using it and practicing it. And that's very much the position that's been advocated for by Michael Tomasello and his collaborators over the years. So that said, that engine gets increasingly more sophisticated as you can use language to understand the nature of the interactions that are happening. I've argued for a lot of continuity in social cognition from very early on until, you know, kind of later in language development. So I think even quite young infants have some sense of how conversation works and how language functions to transfer information between people. But there's some refinement that can happen. One big debate that's happening in the field right now, and that I'm uncertain about the answer to, is whether language plays a really critical role in enabling reasoning about other people's beliefs, either in allowing the discovery of that or at least allowing you to represent other people's beliefs sufficiently. So I think in some sense, the jury is still out about that. Probably language plays some role. Maybe it's not a constitutive role, but so that's one way in which understanding language better could really help drive a social cognitive ability, in this case, theory of mind.
So I've asked you about some of the ways that language acquisition varies cross-culturally, but what do we know about the universality of language acquisition? Are there many human universals in this regard?
Universals, and the question of invariance here has been one of the most controversial topics in language acquisition and cognitive science more generally. So it's very complex to state something like universal, especially when we have data, really, you know, good, rich data about a very small set of the world's current languages, and especially of the languages that have ever existed. Maybe there, you know, hundreds of thousands of languages that have existed, and maybe, 8,000 right now, and we have really good data about just a small handful, a couple of dozen, and really most of the studies have been concentrated in just a tiny number. So it's tough to make strong claims about universality. The way we talk about this with respect to the data that I work on is about relative consistency and variability of different aspects of language learning. So that turns, I think, a really complex kind of black and white, issue about human nature as it's been framed into a statistical question of how consistent a particular phenomenon is across mm-hmm. languages. And so when you use that sort of statistical lens, you can quantify, okay, in the sample we have with all of its limitations, are there things that tend to be relatively more consistent? And I would say, yes, there certainly are. So one thing that's very consistent across languages is how connected different aspects of language are. So when you go to the linguistics department, like we were talking about, you've got sounds and words and word parts and connections between words, syntax and semantics and for meaning. And it sounds like those are really distinct modular things. But one of the biggest generalizations from our work is that when you go across cultures, no matter what culture you're looking at, if you're good at gesturing and communication, you're good at words. If you've got a lot of words, you're good at putting word parts together. And if you're good at putting word parts together, you're good at creating sentences. So structured as a function of individual variability, there's actually a lot of consistency in how tightly woven the language system is, that all of the different parts connect to one another within individuals. That's just an example of something that turns out to be very consistent across languages. I'm not going to call that a universal. We don't have the sample diversity to make that kind of claim, but it is very striking to me that in the languages we study, we really consistently see that.
Mm-hmm. So changing topics, I would like to ask you now a little bit about polite language. I mean, how does it emerge and why do people use it, particularly if we take into account that many times it implies making statements that are imprecise, inefficient, and even sometimes untrue?
Yeah, I love this. So we're going from the question of universality to something that's clearly very, very culturally specific and very culturally conditioned and really fascinating for that reason. So politeness is this way that we navigate the social world using language. In some sense, I like to think of politeness as kind of the expert level, the God mode level of theory of mind, right? If you're good at theory of mind, you're good at tracking other people's beliefs. You're really good at theory of mind, you can manage their expectations, you can manage their feelings, you can manage your own self-presentation and how you appear through your use of language.
Right.
So politeness, roughly speaking, I would say is the set of ways we use language outside of the goal of information transfer to manage our social relationships and our presentation of ourselves. And so this set of ideas comes from the anthropological linguistics literature, where they talk about the use of language to manage face or appearance to the community. And it has a really long tradition because the ways that we go about managing face and using politeness differ so much from culture to culture. I have worked on this topic using a set of ideas about pragmatics that are related to the rational use of language. So my collaborators and I, notably my longtime collaborator, Noah Goodman, and I have proposed this model of pragmatic language use called the Rational Speech Act model. And the basic idea of that model is that you use language to get information across in a way that helps you be sure that another person who's reasoning equally rationally about the language use could figure out what you were trying to say. And so that's fundamentally about information transfer. And we started studying politeness because it's a case where that model really fails. If you just think about language as information transfer, as you said, it's very hard to figure out why you would say these things that are long, vague, imprecise, sometimes even false.
Yeah.
And our answer was, well, you sometimes care about information transfer, but sometimes you care about these other goals, like being nice or looking like a person who's nice, respectful, and so forth. And if you think about the effort that you spend to produce language as a cost, then you're essentially paying that cost to signal that you're a nice or respectful person. So the more verbiage you use, the more you're kind of signaling, hey, I respect you. I feel that it is important that I show how much I respect you by paying this cost. If I say, open the window, okay, that's the most direct information transfer about my desires. But if I say, hey, I'm so sorry to bother you, and I know you're involved in other things, but maybe if you have a moment in the next few minutes, it would be really great if you could just manage to open the window. It's like a caricature, right? I've spent all this time to try to show how much I care about your feelings. Same information, but greater cost. So I'm like kind of burning money here to try to convince you that I care about your, you know, your feelings and respect them.
But when you said at the beginning of your answer that this tends to be very culture specific, what does that mean exactly? I mean, does it mean that what we consider to be polite is culture specific, or that across cultures there are varying degrees of politeness in language?
So both. Almost everything about this particular cultural ritual varies. So in some cultures, it is really critical to use this kind of extra verbiage. And that can be both the kind of unconventional or slightly just unstructured extra verbiage around a request that I just gave my example, or it could be specific markers of politeness that indicate the status relationships. And these are grammaticalized, they're morphology in quite a number of languages. They used to be in English, they are still to a certain extent in Romance languages, where you have formal, informal distinguished by the morphology, but they're much more complex politeness marking systems in a wide variety of other languages. So you get those sorts of markers that can differ, but you also get really big differences in the norms. In some cultures, it's very annoying to ask very slowly and beat around the bush and be indirect. And in some cultures, it's absolutely critical and a marker of respect. So the collaborator that I worked with on this, Erica Yoon, was from Korea, and she had this really interesting experience studying Korean politeness versus politeness in the U.S., and then her third comparison was in India. So she was studying this task where we say, Adam has written a poem and he doesn't know how good the poem is. So he asks Betty, what did you think of my poem? And Betty actually thinks the poem was terrible. This is an example, by the way, that's from J.F. Bonifant originally, but we adapted it. So, okay, Betty's in this dilemma. She thinks the poem is terrible. Does she tell him the poem is terrible? Or does she prevaricate a little bit, say it was not bad, or does she lie and say it was great?
Yeah.
And when we start to query people's intuitions about this cross-culturally, the Americans, I think, typically go with some sort of prevarication. It's, not bad. Yeah, it's okay. Some people liked it. Something like this. We actually got some of our Indian participants saying, well, it's kind of impolite or not right to hold back how bad the poem is, because it's going to hurt Adam in the end. So, Betty really needs to share what's true about the poem in order to help him. And that's how you are most helpful. The Korean participants were much more on the side of being polite about the poem and not sharing the true information about it.
Yeah.
So that's just a tiny little example, but it resonated with us because it felt like it related to these sort of more general cultural norms that you see. I remember a Dutch person was visiting my lab at the time we were doing this research, and she heard this presentation. She said, "Now I understand my own culture. It's totally impolite to withhold direct information. If you had information, how could you not share it?"
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating. And you mentioned Korea there, and I'm somewhat familiar with Japanese culture, for example, and they have one very specific thing there. I'm not sure if in other cultures you also find it, but for example, if someone compliments you, in Portugal and in the US, you would just say something like, "Thank you, oh, you're so nice," something like that. But for example, there, just to give a very specific example, if they compliment your shoes, you're supposed to say, "Oh, they're not that great. Come on." So, they don't like people that brag at all. And so it's not only a thank you, it's, "Oh, they're nothing special." I mean, so there's that, for example. So getting into another topic, tell us about how you use, and how I'm asking you specifically about some of the methodology you use in your studies, how you use eye tracking and head-mounted cameras to study children's early social and visual environment. So tell us about that, and then I will ask some follow-up questions.
Yeah, so I've always been fascinated by the possibility of using different methods to reveal new ways of looking at the human mind, especially when you're talking about very young children. So with adults, there is a lot you can do. It's not perfect, but a well-designed behavioral task can really reveal a tremendous amount about cognition, especially in the moment. You can, you know, ask an adult to perform a complex task many times and really get a good sense of how they make a particular inference. When you're studying learning, and especially when you're studying learning in small children, you have a much more limited behavioral repertoire that you're able to look at. And you're also often interested in the environment of learning. And so those two needs have led developmentalists to get more creative in terms of the particular measures they use to study the learning environment and the consequences of learning. So I got excited about eye tracking by working in Scott Johnson's lab, actually as a research assistant after college. So this is 20 odd years ago. And Scott was very interested in infant development, and he really felt like you could learn a lot about early infancy by looking at eye movements. Because that was part of the infant's behavioral repertoire they were relatively good at, you could get multiple observations of where they would look on a stimulus or how they would predict an outcome by looking at their eye movements. And that rich measure really could reveal much more than, say, a kind of gross motor behavior like a reach, or even just something like a single looking time, which is more commonly used. So I got excited about eye tracking because of that. And I spent a bunch of years really studying dynamics of eye movements in young children and how they modulated their eye movements in different social scenes. That line of research led me to think, well, you know, it would be really nice to know what their social input was. So if we think of their social preferences and their social inferences as stemming from some kind of learning, what are they learning from? When we see, you know, a preference for looking at faces or a preference for looking at hands in certain situations, is that because they're looking at a lot of hands and faces? Is that because the faces and hands are informative in some way? So I started getting excited about this method that was pioneered by a bunch of folks, Linda Smith, Chen Yu, Karen Adolph, and others, where you stick a camera, sometimes an eye tracker, but at least a camera on the child's head, and you measure their visual environment. And as I was setting up my lab, I started playing with this. And it was very exciting to see the child's own viewpoint on the social world, because it looked pretty different than what I had hypothesized. You know, I was showing kids videos that looked like, you know, YouTube videos, maybe focused for kids, but basically, you know, like kind of third person static perspectives. And when you looked at the first person perspective, hands were huge in the field of view. They were, you know, kind of coming in from nowhere and putting an object in the child's field of view. They weren't seeing that many faces because they're down on the ground and the faces are way up above them and so forth. And so I started working with folks in my lab to build different kinds of head-mounted cameras and try to really capture what children are experiencing. This resulted in a longitudinal study called SACAM, where we made a corpus of children's early visual experience that's been really fun to work with for machine learning and computer vision researchers, because it documents the changing perspective and social input over the course of several years for a couple of kids. And we're currently doing a much larger version of this called the Baby View Project, where we're tracking quite a number of kids with baby GoPro rigs, basically trying to get this high resolution, you know, high quality video of what they're experiencing in their social world.
And what do you think this kind of methodology can add to developmental psychology that perhaps other more traditional ways of studying child development wouldn't give us?
Well, when we're talking about cognitive and linguistic development, we're talking about things that are happening inside the head that we can't observe. And that's obvious, but I think really critically important. And so when we're trying to triangulate these latent abilities, we really need to bring a bunch of information to bear on that, especially when we're talking about learning and language. We need to know what the child is learning from their learning environment and their learning input. We need to characterize the dynamics of how they process that information in the moment. And eye tracking can be really helpful for that. And then we need to look at the long-term, large-scale outcome. What have they learned? What's their vocabulary look like? What's their linguistic ability look like more broadly? So if you just have one of those pieces of information, you don't have enough to really pin down what the nature of the learning process is. But in order to characterize the system, you want all of those different pieces of information, and that's going to require some methodological innovation.
Mm-hmm. So to get into the final topic of our conversation today, you've also studied a little bit parenting attitudes. So where do parenting attitudes come from?
That's a very hard one. So I'll start with something a little easier, which is that one of the other discoveries that we made when we looked at children's language across different cultures was that there was something else that was consistent beyond the tight wovenness that I was referring to earlier. Mm-hmm. And that was variability. In every culture we looked at, kids were very different with respect to their path and trajectory into language. Some kids were going faster, some kids were going slower, some kids were learning more grammar, other kids were learning more single vocabulary items. That variability is fascinating to people studying early language. And one of the big goals of early language research is to get a handle on it, try to understand its socioeconomic roots, its genetic roots, its environmental roots, and so forth. And so measuring language input, as we were talking about, using recordings or head-mounted cameras is important there. But it's also important to try to get a sense of what kind of home environment the child is in. And so hence an interest in parenting attitudes and folks' theories of what it means to parent or interact with kids. So that was the broad motivation for studying parenting attitudes. Many people have studied parenting from a lot of different lenses. We developed a questionnaire on this as one entry into this much broader, more complex space. And an earlier observation I made kind of motivates this. There are some cultures that where you get a real deep focus on kids and their development and providing them with really, educational opportunities even before mm-hmm. school. And there are other cultures where you don't see that as much. And so we were interested in measuring cultural and also individual variation on that dimension. Do parents think it's their job to teach their kids? Or are the kids supposed to mostly be learning to be respectful and, kind of good members of the community? And it's not about teaching them words or teaching them the precursors of math or reading to them and so forth. So that was the goal of our parenting attitude questionnaire. And we did find some evidence for individual variation on this dimension. And of course, folks around the world are interested in parenting variation. So we've gotten a lot of uptake, people translating these questionnaires and using them in different places. Mm-hmm. I think it's too soon to say whether we know what the universal dimensions of parenting are. That's a pretty strong kind of set of claims, but we're starting to understand that there are some dimensions of variation that are important across a couple of cultures.
But even if we don't still have that understanding about those dimensions of attitude and how they vary cross-culturally, do we have any idea about where parenting attitudes come from?
I was dodging that question because it's hard. So culture, right? So we have a broad complex of cultural ideas about what parents do and what parents' role is. And in the US especially, but also in Europe to a certain extent, we have, as Alison Gopnik and others have written about, we've come to this idea that parenting is an active activity that we engage in. And it's part of a process of concerted cultivation of our kids for success. And that's quite different than an alternative theory where maybe you have to take care of your kids and it's important to teach them respect, but then the kind of education and formation of the kids is part of the educational system, for example. You send them somewhere. So those two different mindsets seem like they're kind of culturally ingrained and have emerged, you know, especially in the US over the post-war period, or, you know, social mobility, desires for kind of increased engagement, decreasing birth rates. There's kind of a whole set of, you know, important cultural dynamics that lead to us to value the outcomes of individual kids, especially in, you know, middle and higher SES families.
Mm-hmm. And so one last question then. Do we know if beliefs about parenting attitudes actually translate into parenting behaviors?
That, I think we're at early days for understanding exactly how that happens. So it's clear that, you know, at the edges, like the more extreme cases, there are real differences in the ways that parents act, they, in terms of, you know, the language that they produce for kids, but also the kinds of amount of engagement and the richness of the home environment, the amount that parents are preparing their kids for an educational path, versus the amount that they're feeling their responsibility more cultural to pass on cultural traditions, versus the amount they're engaging at all. So it's clear that, you know, from that perspective, from an intuitive perspective, attitudes are translating into action. How much does our questionnaire particularly measure that? Well, we did a little bit of initial validity work to try to test whether parents' reports of their attitudes matched parents' reports of their actual activities, and they did, but really validating in the most, you know, thorough way to really understand whether parents' implicit theories of what it means to be a parent really translate day to day into their observed actions and behaviors. I think that work, you know, from a measurement perspective, still needs to be ongoing.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Frank, just before we go, would you like to tell people where they can find you and your work on the internet?
Oh, thanks for the opportunity. Yeah. So if folks want to engage more, Twitter or X, as it's now called, have become a really good platform for engaging with scientists. And I do try to engage there. It's a lot of fun. Also, if you're interested in any of the resources that we create, because that's very much what we do, is create open resources for studying child development, I encourage you to take a look at our lab's website, langcog.stanford.edu. Which provides links to some of the studies and resources that I've described, including WordBank, which you can Google wordbank.stanford.edu. And that's a really fun resource for exploring child language. And so encourage you to take a look at all of those platforms and play with some of the tools and data sets that we've created.
Great. So I'm leaving links to that in the description box of this interview. And thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much for all your questions.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing, please share the interview, leave a like, a comment. And if you can, please support me on Patreon or PayPal. You can find the links down in the description box. Just $1 per month would already be a great help. This show is brought to you by NLITES, Learning and Development Done Differently. Check their website at nlites.com. And I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Perga Larsen, Jerry Mueller, Hans Frederick Sunde, Bernard Seixas, Olaf Alex, Adam Kessel, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenia, John Connors, Philip Force Connolly, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Nassio, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Simon Columbus, Phil Kavanagh, Mikkel Stormir, Samuel Andrea, Francis Ford, Thiago Nunes, Fergal Cousin, Hal Herzog, Nun Machado, Jonathan Liburant, John Linhares, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, João Weira, Tom Hummel, Sardis France, David Sloan Wilson, Yassi Ladez Araújo, Romain Roach, Diego Londoño Correa, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevski, Nelek Beck, Guy Madison, Gary G. Alman, Sam Afzal, Adrian Yegi, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Julian Price, Edward Hall, Edwin Bronner, Douglas Fry, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litsky, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Sunny Smith, John Wiseman, Daniel Friedman, William Buckner, Paul George Arnaud, Luke Loaki, George Steofanus, Chris Williamson, Peter Wolosin, David Williams, Diogo Costa, Anton Erickson, Charles Moray, Alex Shaw, Amaury Martinez, Coralie Chevalier, Bangalore Atheists, Larry Dealey Jr., Old Herringbone, Sterry, Michael Bailey, Dan Sperber, Robert Grassis, Igor N., Jeff McMahon, Jake Zuhl, Barnabas Radix, Mark Campbell, Thomas Dobner, Luke Neeson, Chris Story, Kimberly Johnson, Benjamin Galbert, Jessica Nowicki, Linda Brandin, Nicholas Carlson, Ismael Benzliman, George Coriatis, Valentin Steinman, Per Crowlis, Kate Von Goller, Alexander Hubbard, Liam Dunaway, B.R., and Masood Ali Mohammadi. Special thanks to my producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Franks, Lucas Tafiniak, Tom Van Egdem, Bernard Eugni, Curtis Dixon, Benedict Mueller, Thomas Trumbull, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Giancarlo Montenegro, Ald Nick Ortiz, and Nick Golden. And to my executive producers, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadrian, Bogdan Kanivets, and Vege G. Thank you for all.